Talkers.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, episode 24. Speak and Destroy is a podcast about all things Metallica, and I am your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is Chuck Billy, Bay Area thrash metal icon and frontman for Testament. When legacy lead singer Steve Zetro-Souza split to join Exodus, Chuck Billy stepped in. Soon after, the band was rechristened as Testament, and Chuck has led them across countless world tours and 11 studio albums, enjoying a career resurgence with recent records like Dark Roots of Earth and Brotherhood of the Snake, alongside co-founding guitarist Eric Peterson and recent Speak and Destroy podcast guest Alex Skolnick, and the legendary rhythm section of bassist Steve DiGiorgio, formerly of Sadus and Death, and Gene Hoagland from Dark Angel and Death as well. The Smithsonian National Museum American Indian exhibit, Up Where We Belong, Native Musicians and Popular Culture, included Chuck, recognizing him for his contributions. He's a cancer survivor, beating back a rare form of the disease he was diagnosed with in 2001. And Testament's friendship with Metallica goes way back, of course. Chuck has taken part in covers of songs like Seek and Destroy and Holier Than Thou, spoken fondly of James Hetfield's influence on him as a singer and lyricist, and even wrote the foreword to the unofficial biography of James Hetfield, So Let It Be Written, authored by Speak and Destroy Episode 2 guest Mark Eglinton. So here it is, my conversation with Chuck Billy. This is Speak and Destroy. I first became aware of Testament courtesy of Headbangers Ball, who would play, you know, the show was 3 hours long and they would play one good video per hour. So my friends and I would tape it on VHS so we could fast forward through all the hair metal videos and find the one, you know, nuclear assault video or whatever that was was buried in there. And Trial by Fire, that was my introduction, and immediately went out and bought the record on cassette and went back and bought the first record, and been thrashing to Testament ever since. So
we're actually on the 30-year anniversary right now of the New Order.
Wow. God, that's right. This year's 30 for Seventh Son of a Seventh Son and Justice for All. Crazy. God, how did that happen?
I know. We turn around, it's like, oh my God, here it is already. But that's okay. You know, I think we're thinking about playing some of it, you know, possibly we're talking about it for the Slayer run, but we haven't decided yet, but I think it'd be something cool.
Yeah, that would be really cool. And obviously going out on that Slayer tour is historic, not only because they're coming off the road after that, in theory, but also you get Gary Holt there. And, you know, there's obviously so much history between Testament and Exodus, and I think that's just going to be a really cool show.
Yeah, it's going to be, it's an awesome package, and I think for the fans, as far as the fans go, it's going to be a great day of, extreme metal, that's for sure.
Yeah. So, take me all the way back to your discovery process with music in general, and how that led into heavy music. I know in reading interviews with you in the past that you've cited, Sabbath, UFO, Judas Priest, a lot of classic metal and hard rock bands as early entry points for you. What did you have? I know you have siblings. Did you have family members that were into music, parents? Where did that first come from for you?
Yeah, I had older brothers and younger brothers that were into music. My older brother played guitar and sang, but he was more into stuff like Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Hendrix in that kind of era. So, but the music was always the interest, you know, and with our age gap, it was heavy for us was, you know, Kiss when it was first coming out, you know, opposed to them listening to Led Zeppelin, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was always kind of on the heavier side of music, I guess, as far as imagery and, the underdog kind of players, you know, I was always, you know, that old guitar. I was always driven towards the guitar, you know, because I always, you know, originally was a guitar player before I became a singer. So I was always drawn to the Michael Schenkers or Randy Rhoads and those kind of bands.
Yeah, it seems like, Sabbath, Motorhead, the Scorpions, UFO. It seems like a lot of those bands were, you know, kind of essential components and building blocks into what became thrash and the Bay Area thrash sound. Like, you know, I hear those influences cited often by each of you gentlemen that are architects of that particular sound. What do you think?
It was great in that scene. You know, growing up in that time was, for me, where I hit the crossroad of it. That was right when, like, Exodus was doing the first demos for Bonded by Blood. And, you know, it was really like a new thing in Metallica as well. And, you know, at the time, my introduction to more of the heavier part was doing my first recording for, like, a early band, Guilt, that was in. And mm-hmm. Exodus was doing recording Bonded by Blood in the next room over. I were in Prairie Sun.
Oh, wow.
So I was recording vocals, and I heard Paul recording vocals, like, screaming, like, what the hell's going on? You know? And it was Paul Baloff laying down vocals, and, like, that's Exodus, you know, recording their Bonded by Blood record. We go from time to time and leave my trail of death. And if you don't surrender, you'll be their final breath. There will be no survivors, no prisoners of war. Join our ranks or perish, we'll slice you through the core. This song in the air, flashing everywhere. Flying in the sound, faces of the ground. It's time to fight for metal tonight. Fire, take your star, enemy. Our hands are covered. And I already knew the demo that was going around the bay and stuff at the time. And so I was like, well, holy shit, you know, because I was not in Testament or Legacy. I was totally far from that at that point. And then as it would be, you know, a year or so later, you know, year and a half later or so, I was in Legacy, you know.
Yeah, and man, Bailiff's, to go back to that, you know, the Guilt era for a second, Bailiff's vocals just so unhinged and wild and drenched in reverb, and, you know, I feel like, and this isn't to take anything away from seeing him live or other recorded performances of his, but there's something magical about that Bonded by Blood recording in particular, where I feel like they got lightning in a bottle with that guy on that record, where it's just... it's just like he's from another world or something. It had to be crazy to hear from the other side of, you know, from right next door.
Yeah, and the riffs and what Paul was all about, you know. It was such catchy riffs, but aggressive, catchy riffs. And, you know, with Paul, his style with that screechy style with a lower voice, you know, it was unique, you know. But to know Paul, you'd be like, yep, that's Paul. You know?
Yeah. It's like the Tasmanian devil or something.
Pretty much.
So what was your introduction to Legacy? Did you see them play before you met them, or how did you first become aware?
Well, Zet was Steve, who was singing for Legacy. Him and my younger brother, Andy, were best friends. Hmm. So Zet grew up around my house and my family, and I see them a lot. And my brother was a guitar player, and so, you know, Zet was actually joined Legacy and was playing us the demo and stuff, and me and some friends went and seen them play one time out in Alameda, you know, at a club, and I heard the demo, and I was just kind of blown away the first time around, just kind of like the three song demo I heard, just how mature the song was for, like, you know, Alex being like 15 years old and Eric, you know, like 18 years old, writing these really sophisticated kind of songs and mature sounding songs, and I was like, wow. But Alex's playing was like incredible for his age, and I was like, man, I got something here, you know. And so Zett, we were all gung-ho for Zett, you know, like, right on, man, he's got a cool thing. And then out of the blue, you know, within, you know, a month after starting some shows, he dropped the bomb that, you know, Exodus, he's going to leave Legacy to join Exodus. And he actually came to my house, you know, my younger brother, and told us, like, hey, man, I'm leaving the Exodus, our Legacy, to join Exodus. Here's Alex Skolnick's phone there. I want you to give him a call. They're going to be looking for a singer.
Oh, wow.
And right at that time, I just finished, like, taking private lessons and you know, I had actually went to college for about a year, taking, like, guitar and theory and vocals and just trying to become a singer. And so the timing was just right at the time when, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to try to look for a band, and that dropped that in my hands. And it was, and they already had a record deal, you know, but, you know, Megaforce, of course, wanted to hear a new demo with me singing. And sent them the same three songs that Zett did on his demo, and they came out to see us, and you know, that was a whole another kind of awkward experience. You know, with the day they came to see our audition in Oakland, that morning, you know, they showed up to the studio and they were just like wore out because they had been up all night, because that was the night before they had found out that Cliff had, you know, the bus wreck the night before.
Oh, wow. So that would have been September 86.
Yep. So it was a somber day for us when we had our audition. And Johnny and Marcia and Maria were out in San Francisco for our audition. And we all kind of took the news just like, oh, my God, and, you know. And it was the weirdest thing. We did our three-song audition. It was kind of like, okay, yeah, we got a deal. And it was kind of like, that was about it. But it was kind of the most somber audition, you know, of, you know, just because everything was going down with Cliff.
Yeah, nobody's in a celebratory mood in the Bay Area thrash scene.
No, it was kind of like, okay, you got to get home. And they were, because they were just still devastated out of their mind, you know.
Yeah. Man, yeah, what a crazy time. And I know from knowing her over the years, and from knowing both of them a little bit, Maria was actually the person who told Dave Mustaine the news. I just, man, wow. The conversations that had to be happening were just, had to be so brutal. So going backwards a little bit, you know, when I had Alex on the show, you know, he talked about his vantage point toward Metallica being, you know, in a way a peer and a contemporary, but in another way a fan. And, you know, he was a little bit younger than those guys, and I think, like, him and Rob Flynn were in high school when you know, No Life Till Leather came out and that sort of thing. What was your experience and an introduction into you know, hearing Metallica for the first time and becoming aware of them?
Well, it was early on, you know, definitely through just kind of the scene and us early, just kind of being from Dublin, me and Zett and Bill Demmel and those guys, being somewhere where we didn't have concerts. We always had to venture into Berkeley or San Francisco, you know. So it kind of was part of the scene and just the talk, because when we were in the Bay Area at that point, it was more of a glam metal scene and punk rock, you know. That was more of the scene coming in the early 80s into those mid-80s. And for this whole new movement, just so like bam, so quick, it spread so fast, and just parties and just the vibe and the following just grew quick for that style of music, you know. And Metallica, when they came through, you know, I remember going, like, to the old Waldorf, you know, to those shows. And I remember, I think it might have been the first time I seen him. I definitely was underage. I think I got thrown out.
first time for
drinking, you know. Yeah, I mean, that, I remember that. That was probably one of the memorable ones that was, like, etched in my brain when I first seen him. Because that place was, like, you know, really small place, but it was, had you know, I guess looking back, thinking back now, it seemed like, you know, the Coliseum lightings, but I'm sure it wasn't. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
Back now, but they came out so powerful and like, so holy shit, what is this? Like, you know, my God. But I had seen Cliff before because Cliff, actually, my senior year of my continuation, he played there at the school with his band Trauma.
Oh, wow.
So I knew of Cliff and his abilities, like when my high school year, like holy shit, you know, he was amazing. And one of his best friends, Mike Yastrzemski, was in one of our bands growing up, Rampage, that my little brother was in. You know, that was kind of a part of, you know, me and him were roadies for them. So it was just, you know, the small world. So we knew of Cliff, and that's when he got into Metallica, that whole thing, like, holy shit, the, you know, crazy Cliff from bass player from Trauma is now, you know, playing Metallica.
He's bringing his bell bottoms to Metallica. Yeah. And, yeah. And making them come to him, which is such an amazing part of that Cliff story. You know, if you want me in the band, you got to move here.
And things and fans grew so quick, and, you know, and that was such a great time. And then, you know, we still had the Day on the Greens, you know, those were like awesome, you know. And what a platform for Metallica to get and play a Day on the Green before they went away, and, you know, just launch them in that sense where, you know, they were destined at that point. But for us in the Bay Area, for them to play the Day on the Green was just like, holy shit, you know.
Well, I tell you, if you came here to see fucking spandex and fucking makeup and hairspray and all this crap, this ain't the fucking band. We came here to bash our fucking heads together for 45 minutes. What about you? All right.
Hometown heroes from that very small but vibrant scene kind of getting onto the mainstream stage, in a sense, playing Day on the Green, probably seemed like an unreachable pinnacle at that point. You know, little did we know.
Well, back, we didn't really have those kind of things. I mean, after that, even growing up, like, you know, we're especially experiencing all the festivals in Europe, and you think, man, America doesn't have that. But, you know, Day on the Green or like the US Festival, I went to the US Festival, you know, and experienced that, you know, and like, wow, we don't have that anymore here. Nothing like that huge, you know.
Yeah. So you've talked before about the impact of Kill 'Em All in particular, and I know, you know, of course, with Metal Allegiance, you've done Seek and Destroy, and there's that cover you did with Jakey Lee. Talk to me a little bit about that record and what you remember about getting it and that sort of thing. And part of that question, were you familiar with the, you know, the demos that were going around beforehand and already kind of into those songs, or what was your experience with that album?
I was with the demos, but mostly when the record came out is when I really got it, because I was still at that point where I was still trying to get it, and you know, was still like, I'm here, I know of it, but I was still learning, you know. Like, around all that time is when I didn't kind of understand it, especially for me coming through more of an era of more like UFO and Thin Lizzy and more rock and melody and stuff like that, to where thrash music was totally different, you know. And so as a vocalist, hearing thrash music, timing of the vocals was, to me, was like, oh, like hearing it for the first time was like, wow, you know, it was so outer space to me. So
yeah, the phrasing was almost like percussion versus melody in a way. Yeah,
it's all timing and syllables. And the first time I'm working with Eric on all the songs written, and that's pretty much what it was. It's like syllables and cadence and trying to follow the music, and one, two, three, now, and it's so off time, and I'm like, whoa, I feel like I should be coming on the one, and it's some weird off beat, you know, it was so new to me, like, you know, where to come in, and the timing of it, and stop singing here, and fit all these words in right here, you know. It's like, so yeah, so like I was still getting it, and then so once I got it, even the earlier Exodus and Paul and Metallica and, you know, all the other stuff like that, I started really relating to and getting, you know, having a crash course, especially my first year in the band. You know, by the second year we were writing the New Order record, you know, and I got to get in on the writing. So right away I was just thrown in the fire, like, okay, you're singing, you got to write. And we did a pretty good job, like within a year later, write songs like that.
I love that first record, but yeah, I really feel like the New Order is when the band really, the identity of what we think of as Testament really coalesced in terms of the sound. And yeah, like you said, things happening quickly. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the next two records came out over the next 2 years, right? Wasn't it like Preach was like 89 and Souls, yeah.
4 years, four years in a row. 5 years we put out a record. 87, 88, 89, 90, and 91. We had a record out every year. And so, yeah, we're popping them out.
That's like Kiss, you know, like you mentioned Kiss earlier. Yeah. One of the few bands I can think of that did that, and, you know, without compromising quality to put out records that quickly. It's that's pretty impressive.
Well, at that point when we all lived home and we're like just, you know, living under mom's roof probably and just writing songs and having focused, and that really is something to it, you know. We're just like the New Order, like we're in Europe going, man, this is a weird place over here. We're there, you know, for like a few times in 87 and into 88. We wrote a lot of the New Order in the back of the bus on acoustic guitar. We just played it acoustic and tapped out the vocals, had all the patterns and, so, I mean, yeah, it was, we were just ready to go. It's just like, you know, we had to keep writing.
That's so impressive. I mean, what a run, and what an exciting time for this style of music right there in the late 80s and early 90s in particular, when we think about so many records that are classics of the genre and you know, foundational building blocks all came out so close together. It's just really crazy to think about it. And, you know, when people do these retrospectives right now, when it's like, you know, what's the best record from 86 or what's the best record from 88? It's like, how do you choose? You know, it's like, it's not fair.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and music's weird. It all depends who you were in 1986, you know?
Right.
You know, how that record affected you, you know?
Yes, man, I always say that. Time, place, and circumstance, right? Where it's, who were you and... what was going on in your life? What had you heard before that? What did was it the gateway to that it introduced you to? And yeah, a lot of times this or that record is favored by us for those reasons. And I think sometimes people are blind to that. You know, you get into debates with someone and a lot of times I'll peel it back and I'll go, oh, well, you think that's the best Slayer record? Well, what was the first Slayer record you heard? Oh, it was that one? Okay, well, no wonder. You know, you could kind of... And sometimes I even get into the distinction of best and favorites, you know, where there's a record in a band's catalog where I can go, well, objectively that one's the best, but it's not my favorite. My personal favorite is this one, you know, so.
Yeah, 'cause in, like for me, music, like, you know, music is supposed to take you to a happy place, to get away. And there's even old songs that, you know, that I'll hear like growing up that's on the radio and I'll forget about. And when I hear them, like, oh, it takes me right back.
Mm-hmm.
To sit in the back and my mom and dad's car, you know, like, you know, going somewhere. It just brings you right back to that memory of the first time you hear, like, some songs. And those are always, like, good feelings, like, for music, you know, when music takes you somewhere like that right away to a good place.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, for me, like, growing up, I always tend, when I listen to music, I always go back to my favorites, like, a lot of what I listened to in high school, you know, I would go back to UFO or Thin Lizzy or Michael Schenker or stuff that I just, like, pop in and it takes me back to this time where I can, you know, makes me get a little smile and thinks about the good old times.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
That's, you know, the Ultraviolence and the New Order, and that's a lot of those records for me. That was, you know, I was in high school, and that's, you know, that's, I can hear anything from Practice What You Preach, you know, and immediately be transported back in time. One of my, probably my oldest friend that I'm still in regular contact with, we were in bands together in high school and discovering all that music together. And yeah, we figured out just the other day that we've been friends for 30 years. So I guess it makes sense that the New Order is 30 years old, you know?
Wow.
Yeah. It could take you right back there for sure. Now when Ride the Lightning came out, you know, this is something, and one of the exciting things about Metallica is all of the different decisions they've made creatively and business-wise and so on. It's like being a fan, I think, of sports, of like a different team, where you can talk about the year that they had this coach or this quarterback or whatever and get into these fun conversations. I know, going all the way back to Ride the Lightning, which was a little before my time in terms of being aware of them, that there were fans who were already complaining that there was a ballad on the record. And I've read some quotes from you in the past where you've said that, and I'm right there with you, that some of the Metallica ballads are your favorite Metallica songs. So I'm curious, you know, when you heard Fade to Black and when that record was coming out, what your reaction was to it then.
Well, I mean, for me, I enjoyed it just because it was another side to the thrash Metallica I was introduced to. So, you know, for me, I enjoyed it, and I thought they did a great job at it. And, you know, it didn't hit me wrong. It hit me right.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, you know, I enjoy the ballad stuff they do when they shift gears. You know, especially in the early years, I thought they did it very clever, and James's lyrics are always very clever and very meaningful, and it works really well, you know, when they first started introducing that. You know, I'd say over the years, you know, I would say it's changed some, but those early years introducing a lot of that, I really enjoyed and thought it was a, you know, for a band at that point who would say, we'll never be commercial and do a video and all that stuff, had some material that just, like, was geared up for, you know, a mass, you know, audience recognizing it, you know, and having some sort of medium to expose it.
And I love that when they finally did make a video, it was still this disruptive, you know, complicated, different type of video. And at that point, they were so popular that MTV had to play a Metallica video versus them courting MTV, you know. So it's like, we're going to have this war video with all this dialogue from this old movie cutting into the music.
Right.
I thought that was...
But it was clever, you know, all of it. I just, you know, everything Metallica does, I've always just, you know, and being just thought, wow, that was very smart, clever. You know, and just, and a lot of things they do, you know, the way they carry themselves in business, and it's killer. I really fully down with Metallica, what they've accomplished.
Now, as you were, as Testament was on the ascent, you know, both creatively and commercially, and obviously touring all the time and so forth, you know, I think as fans, we tend to associate, of course, the Big Four. And I think by anyone's estimation, you know, Exodus and Testament, would be the other two bands that would, you know, if it were the Big Five or the Big Six, you know, those are the obvious choices. And yet, one thing that's almost hard to believe in retrospect is that Testament didn't play with Metallica for like decades. like that pretty much just happened semi recently, right?
Yeah, a few years ago in Germany, I think we had two shows, first time ever sharing the stage.
how did those two ships keep passing for so many years? Like it's
you know, I
crazy.
Asked that same question for 30 years.
He probably thought you'd played together, right? Like, no, we've played together, right? And you're like, nope, we haven't.
I don't know the reason, but I don't know. Maybe one day.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, though you didn't play shows together in that time, clearly there was a relationship. I'm curious what you remember about, you know, were they, did those guys come out to Testament shows when they were home and vice versa?
Yeah. I mean, even like right around the Legacy and when we first came out with the first record, and the New Order, they used to always come, even Practice What You Preach, all the shows we played. Like I said, we did one every year, so we constantly had new music, and the show was getting bigger, and you know, we're making some noise. So they were coming to the shows, you know. Yeah, it was just, they were busy, and we were kind of busy at that point, doing, moving quick, because we were, like I said, a record every year in touring. We didn't stop, you know, for those first 5 years.
Now, you know, Metallica has been so transparent with their fans and the global audience to a fault with their inner workings and the relationships between the guys. And in a lot of ways that, you know, James especially is very private in terms of his family and his personal views and all that, which I respect. But I also do like how they've given us this window into how the dynamics within the band works. I think there's a lot of, you know, the two guys that directed that documentary have said that their relationship was parallel to things that were happening within Metallica. You know, you don't have to be in a band even to get that. But I'm always curious, you know, when I think about Testament, and obviously I'm a huge fan of Alex, both as a player and as a person, but I really think about that duo of you and Eric, as, you know, you were you're consistent guys that have been flying the Testament flag the entire time. You know, you're both on all the records, and
yeah.
Do you see any, you know, when you see something like Some Kind of Monster, do you see any parallels in that bond between
Not
James and Lars? No?
Not in our camp. You know, I think we're very fortunate, everybody. I think in our case, because it took us to do a breakup to realize, you know, if we're going to do it a second time around. You know, I think we're prepared the second time around because we're all matured and grown up. And first time around, you know, I think the age difference and going on the road and Alex being as young as he was, he never experienced his teenage years, his first, you know, 6-7 years from 15, you know, to 23 or whatever, he was on the road.
Yeah.
Until he left the band, you know, so things grew up, happened fast and grew apart quick at the end, you know, when we had the breakup. And so for him to, you know, come back, you know, that was like a whole nother thing, you know, it was like, you know, it took, I think, you know, I hate to say it, but almost like my illness having cancer to get Testament back together and quite a few other Bay Area bands actually at that point, you know, because of the show.
Yeah, Thrash of the Titans. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was kind of opened the door for Alex and Greg and Louie all came out for that. And at that time we were recording First Strike Still Deadly album.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked Alex if he was into playing the solos, and he came in and he did the next day after the show. And right away, it just, his playing and the licks, and he wrote those leads. It just took me right back to, like, again, took me back to a place, you know,
mm-hmm.
that I remembered you know, Alex playing and just his style, and it was like, wow. And, you know, and as the universe kept spinning, our friend Andre from the Dynamo called me up and said that he had the original Anthrax together and was going to play at Dynamo Festival. What's the chances of getting the original Testament?
Mm.
So I said, oh, I can ask. And it was not too long after that Thrash of the Titan show. And everybody said, you know, I told him it was Anthrax and, you know, the Testament's original and kind of makes sense. And everybody said, yeah, kind of makes sense. That would be fun. And so everybody said, let's do it. So we got everybody, you know, all the way from Louis and the total original lineup. And one show kind of turned into 10 shows, and then it turned into a few months, and then, you know, a few years later, well, not shortly after, Louis couldn't play because of his arthritis. So that's when we had to decide that he's going to step down and Gene Hoagland's going to come in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then Greg left not too long ago, decided that he was going to call it quits. And then Steve DiGiorgio came back into the picture, who played on the Gathering record.
And that rhythm section right now, by the way, I mean, that, you know, those two guys made my favorite death records. You know, and of course, you know, Darkness Descends is a classic. I mean, you know, Gene's obviously played on so many amazing records. And, you know, I would argue.
Stellar backup.
Yeah. And I would argue that Dark Roots and Brotherhood of the Snake are two of the best Testament albums. I mean, I've never sat down and ranked them, but I know those two would rank really highly for me, maybe even number two and three. And, you know, that's Modern Testament. So,
yeah, we're pretty proud of the Modern Testament. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's just weird the way this all evolved and how it came around, you know, because at the time when I got ill, there was kind of a revolving door of drummers, bass players, guitar players. So we weren't really like touring and working hard. You know, we kind of almost like gave up and just kind of like, you know, did shows here and there. So once Alex and the reunion happened, that's when we kind of decided to shift gears and say, you know, let's be a touring band again. And so at that point, since we've been touring a lot, you know, I think things have picked up, momentum's picked up. We've kind of spread the word that we're doing it, we're having fun, you know, where there's no issues in the band, no drama. So it's like, it's all good right now.
That's great. And, you know, what's funny is you mentioned earlier seeing Cliff playing in Trauma, you know, in continuance school. And then you mentioned, you know, Greg leaving the band not that long ago. I believe he's playing bass in Trauma now, right?
Oh, yeah.
So talk about just, the small world and the full circle and all the weirdness that we're kind of talking about. Like, that seems to fit right in some crazy way.
Yeah, it's a small world.
And kind of, you know, getting back to that, then that sort of mid-90s era, and obviously, you know, what we touched a little bit on what was going on with Testament in that time, mid to late 90s. Early 90s even, I love that when Testament covered Metallica that you did a Black Album song, because I'm an adamant defender of the Black Album. I love it start to finish. You know, I think it sold another 4,000 or 5,000 copies last week, which is insane. What was your feeling when the Black Album came out? And you know, I can imagine there was a sense with a lot of bands, and it's come up on the podcast before, of the you know, the big wave lifting all ships, and that record kind of taking things to a new level and widening
what's
possible.
I remember like the night I was seeing Enter Sandman, you know, that I remember where it was the gym, it was basketball league. Right after the game, I can't remember, halftime, it was like, the video's going to be on. So we all like gather around the video or the TV. And that video came on, it was like, holy shit. You know, it was just so heavy. It was just like, it was like definitely shifting into a whole nother level. Me and my friends just looked and said, holy shit. You know, that was just like, wow. It was definitely like the tone and the drums and how big it was. And that song, it was just so catchy and the hook and so clever again, you know, and it was like, wow. And I was at the gym with my friend Willie Lang, and he was in, was actually almost was the bass player in Metallica. You know, he was up against Jason Newsted, who's been Jason and Willie.
Oh, wow.
So me and Willie's always been a close follower and still a friend of Metallica guys and stuff. So we're together when we seen the video together, and we're just like, holy shit, and we're just like blown away on the production of it.
Just so heavy and yet also so deceptively simple. I remember when someone pointed out to me that Inner Sandman is basically one riff the entire time, and then it's I never heard the song the same way again. I was like, wow, you're right. It's brilliant. It's crazy, you know.
Yeah, it's so simplistic, but it's all on the cadence of the drums. You know, just crazy. But yeah, it was you know, from, you know, them being known as fast and thrashing, it was just the overall power of it is what just like bulldozed you.
And does that then open up conversations, you know, within a band like Testament, who are peers and friends and that sort of thing, where you go, okay, now this is, you know, here's another level of what's possible?
Of course, everybody wants to like sound like that. It's like, okay, we need to get the drums big like that, you know, and just hear the guitars, you know. Yeah, you know, that's what everybody, they set the bar. And in the recording world, you're always trying to like, okay, put that Metallica song on again, and you know, got to be that big. And it's just, there's no way you find the magic of something like that. That just, you know, some mixes are just magical like that.
Yeah, I remember I was talking to my buddy CeCe, who plays drums in the band Black Veil Brides, and they did a record with Bob Rock a couple of years ago. And he was telling me about one of his first conversations with Bob, and Bob was saying, you know, so what kind of drum tones are you into? Like, what are, you know, what are some reference points or some records that you like that we should kind of aim for? And CeCe was just like, the Black Album? Like, produced by you, Bob Rock? Like, that'll work. Right. Just do that again.
Yeah, that'll work. Just give me that one.
Yeah, push that button.
It was only that easy, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But it is these days.
yeah. Now, well, I mean, God, you know how many records your drummer has played on that no one knows about?
Yeah. Now you can have this tone.
Yeah.
You know?
I think some of those programs are literally Gene playing the drums, if I'm not mistaken.
They are.
Yeah, he's at least on a lot of pre-production demos, if not, you know, who knows how many finished albums. That's
no
great.
Doubt.
So, yeah, you know, kind of moving forward into the 90s, I know obviously the Load Reload era is a controversial subject when it comes up on this podcast. People in different camps and with different points of view. I know that you've expressed that wasn't your favorite period in the band. And, you know, what's interesting, and I think what was also really healthy for the metal scene, you know, we had the Black Album, and then around the same time we got this sort of, you know, Pantera went on steroids. And then, you know, later in the 90s, when Load and Reload and stuff like that is happening, bands like Testament delves kind of more into the more extreme side. And I personally think that all of that's really healthy, you know, that there's these dynamics within the scene and you know, different types of records for all of us to check out. Were there songs from that era that eventually connected with you in some way? Or you know, I know, you know, some people have said that when they see the band live now and they hear Fuel. In fact, Alex was one of the people who said this, you know, that all of a sudden you go, oh, I didn't think I liked that song, but it works in this live setting, you know, the dynamics of it or whatever. Did you have kind of a similar experience, or what was your take on that era?
It wouldn't be my first choice of songs to pick, like, for the live set.
Right.
I would think that over time, they probably have gotten better playing those songs and perfected. And James probably singing them a little better. To me, when I hear some of those records, and I love James and I love his brilliance and how clever he is, those lyrics didn't grab me. James didn't grab me like he normally did with those lyrics and just the phrasing of it. I mean, I don't know, just it didn't hit me like it did, like the other records just grabbed me, like, you know, by the collar and it pulled you right in. So that's why they weren't my most favorite. I would think if the music was, you know, mediocre and was really, James had some really killer clever shit that grabbed me, and it'd be a different story, but it just, all of it together just didn't grab me. So that's why, that's just that era. I mean, if I'm going to hear a record and put on Metallica, I'm not grabbing that one to play.
Yeah.
that's all, just at that one.
Fair enough. And, you know, while we're hanging out here in this late 90s, mid to late 90s era, you know, I've had Andreas on from Sepultura on the podcast, and a little while back I had Igor on as well, and both of them, you know, we talked about a little bit about the split with Max, primarily because you know, I know that they were tight with Jason Newsted, and there was, you know, rumors that Newsted was perhaps a possibility to front Sepultura, but both of them talked about and very favorably your audition for Sepultura, and that you had you know, put some stuff to tape and got in front of them, and they both had very kind and appreciative things to say about that. What can you tell me from your perspective about that moment in time? And, you know, as a comic book fan, I think of it as like a what if alternate universe. You know, what if Chuck Billy would join Sepultura?
It was a last minute decision. I don't know if we just hit a crossroad to where, I don't know if I was just things. Was there some grass greener on the other side? I don't know. But it was just kind of a last-minute thing. I said, you know what, I'm going to do a demo. And I just sang three songs and sent it in. And when I sent it, they just right away said, you know, thanks so much. But, you know, unfortunately, we had already chosen Derek already. We had already had our mind made up, you know. Well, thanks. You know, we wish you maybe you'd have sent it sooner. And, you know, good luck. And that was it. You know? And... yeah, it is a what if, you know, and you know, as the world turns, well, I wouldn't have the three records I do right now.
Exactly. You know, and something that both of them talked about, which I think was ultimately probably a smart move for them, they didn't want to get somebody who was a contemporary or a peer or, you know, because once you combine, then it become, you know, then it's Sammy and Van Halen, you know, it's like two forces coming together, and I think they really wanted somebody that was more of an unknown that would just kind of be absorbed into the Sepultura thing rather than, you know, it would inevitably be Sepultura plus Testament in the mind of all of us fans, you know, because it's just, you know, two big presences combining. So yeah, definitely everything happened the way it should have.
Yeah, the universe wasn't lined up for that one.
Indeed. And thank God, because we got all these records we've been talking about much more recently. Second guest I had on the, you know, we're 20-something episodes deep on the podcast. The second guest I had was Mark Eglinton, who wrote the So Let It Be Written book on James Hetfield.
Right.
And the foreword is, of course, by Chuck Billy. What can you tell me about that, and how did that come about, and... you know, what was important to you to express when you put pen to paper, so to speak, in crafting that intro?
Mark approached me, you know, I think he was talking, working, trying to do a test as well. But he approached me about doing that, being from the Bay Area, and I was very honored, and like, of course, you know. Can't remember what I wrote, but I'm sure it's all good stuff. But I mean, James is a big inspiration and a big part of who the Bay Area is known for around the world and the universe, you know. The Bay Area, old school Bay Area, you think Metallica, you know, right away, and that's just some of the old metalheads. So I thought it was just a very, very cool thing. I thought I was honored.
Did you get an opportunity to mention that to James? Does he know that you wrote that forward?
I don't think so. I don't know. I didn't mention it, you know.
Yeah, just you're always curious what crosses the radar and what doesn't. I would imagine he would hear about it.
Whenever I cross paths with James, it's at a Giants game or Raider game.
Nice.
There's some sporting event, you know. So, you know, we don't talk shop. We just, hello, James, how you doing? How's the family? And, you know, keep it short.
Yeah. You should ask him about bee farming. I don't know if you heard him on Joe Rogan's podcast, but he went on a whole thing about raising. Yeah, so cool. Yeah. And it's funny, at a certain point, Joe Rogan, you know, James is like, your listeners don't want to hear this. And he's like, no, they do. And I'm in my car going, yes, I do. keep talking about the bees. This is awesome. I was totally into it.
Yeah. I know. Shortly after I listened to that, I drove by a little bee farm. Just reminded me of him. Like, I can't see James out there like with his mask. And
harvester of honey, I guess would be the.
Yeah, harvester of honey. Yeah.
So awesome. Well, yeah, and that brings me to the last thing I wanted to ask you about, actually, you know, when talking about Mark and books in general. I know that you'd mentioned a year or two ago that there was possibly a Testament documentary and or book in the works. Was that is that something that's moving forward or backburnered? Or
we still have all the footage of the documentary. We still have some people to interview. We just haven't put a time stamp on when it's going to be finished. Yeah, I don't know. Definitely something's going to come out. And we're actually talking about another photographer friend of ours is going to possibly do just like a picture coffee table book. Some really old, cool stuff that has never been released that he's had. And he goes way back, and he's done a lot of sessions with us in the early days that we couldn't even remember. He had mentioned that he'd seen. He's like, oh, my God, you guys are going to believe it. So there could be something cool coming out in the future. So our friend Gene Ambo, Gene, is our friend from Chicago. He grew up with all the Anthrax guys, shot a lot of their early games.
Oh, cool.
And Bay Area guy. So, yeah, he's got so much stuff. I guess Kerrang, when, you know, they stopped being metal, I guess they had all the slides of all the early 80s photographers there. That they couldn't do anything with all that work. So they just sent out all these letters. I know a lot of photographers that ended up going to London. They just were at our show last week. They were going there to Crane to all gather their slides and their photos back.
That's so cool.
So all these photographers got all these archives of all this old cool shit. So we're going to take that and make it into a nice cool picture book display. That particular photographer.
That is badass. Definitely.
Yeah.
If you need a foreword or bios or anything for any of that stuff, drop me a line.
Yeah.
Happy to contribute.
Yeah, maybe you get a hold of if you, James can do it for me.
Yeah, exactly. A turnabout is fair play.
Right.
That's awesome. And, you know, well, last thing while I got you here, you mentioned, you know, we talked about Thrash of the Titans and you mentioned the illness a while back. And I haven't, you know, I don't see it come up, which I always figure no news is good news. But everything all good?
I'm all good. I get my checkups annually, and I take care of myself. You know, I quit drinking. I'm just trying to be a little more healthy, health conscious, and taking it day by day. And I'm good to go. You know, performing
awesome.
Better than ever. You know, my voice is feeling stronger than ever, and. Good, and we're preparing to write a new record by the end of this year. So
nice,
you're looking good.
Well, Chuck, thanks so much for making this happen. I feel like I hear myself say this a lot, but I've been blessed to cross some people off the wish list. But you were right there towards the top when I kind of came up with the idea of doing a Metallica podcast, and so it's awesome to have you on here.
Having me, man.
Follow Chuck on Twitter at ChuckFCKNBilly. That's Chuck fucking Billy without the U, I, or G. And be sure to follow Speak and Destroy on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, where we are constantly posting bits of Metallica history. The Speak and Destroy YouTube channel is constantly updated with playlists collecting all sorts of rare clips, and SpeakandDestroy.com features some deep dives with our guests. And you know the drill. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a review. Make sure to check out past episodes with guests like M. Shadows, David Ellefson, Rob Flynn, Blasco, Andreas Kisser, Lizzie Hale, Jamie Josta, and more. Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. Check out our sister show, No Prize from God, which features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. Guests have included folks from Killswitch Engage, Emperor, Integrity, Alter Bridge, Demon Hunter, Under Oath, and more. You can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at Superhero HQ. As always, you guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downey.